if negotiations fail.
Thing is, Kath, it's not just embarrassing, as one of those guys said. It's potentially disastrous, isn't it? Do you think that they think that it will be resolved, that it will be sorted out at the last minute?
I think it's almost a mixed bag there, Nick. We've seen this kind of thing before. Earlier this year, we saw the potential of a government shutdown because, again, the US Congress couldn't come to an agreement on how to deal with the US level now before the deadline passed. There is some in the camp that say, look, we know this is playing into the election campaign of 2012. They're playing to their constituents. But there is this other side of the coin, which is people who don't necessarily follow the ins and outs of the debate, but they know that there will be some kind of knock-on effect if the government cannot pay its bills. They send millions of checks to Americans every month through their federal welfare programs, through education programs, to people who have Medicare. So there's a side of the coin which of Americans who are genuinely worried that if this doesn't get resolved and there is no solution, that check won't arrive in the mail. This is still an economy which is very damaged from the recession of 2008. Many people still out of a job, the unemployment stubbornly high, and people relying on those checks. If they don't come in the mail, then there are millions of Americans who will be affected. So there is that sense of genuine concern and fear that this government, while it continues to go back and forth and not look like a resolution, that it will have a spill-on effect and they will be affected, maybe not on August 3, the day after the deadline, but down the road a week, 2 weeks later.
Yeah, interesting times, Kath. See what happens. Thanks a lot, Kath Turner, in the United States. Well, meanwhile, the US risks losing its AAA credit rating if lawmakers fail to reach a deal. But the agencies who rate government debt are themselves facing scrutiny in Congress. On Wednesday, lawmakers grilled executives from the two biggest agencies, that's Standard & Poor's and Moody's, on their role in the debt crisis.
Do you think that it is the job of a credit agency to get involved in trying to make a decision one way or the other on a political basis? Do you think that's interference?
Congressman, sovereign debt is a large asset class that many investors around the world invest in. And our role is to really provide an independent view and a future forward-looking view for the investors as to what the risk levels are for those assets that they invest in. And that's what we are doing today.
Now, the heaviest rains in a century have triggered landslides in South Korea's capital and surrounding areas. At least 32 people have been killed and several more are missing. More than 700 houses have been flooded throughout the country. Seoul has been hit with 38 centimeters of rain in the past 17 hours and expects more through the week. 89 babies have been rescued in China after being kidnapped for sale. Police have arrested 369 people linked to two human trafficking rings. More than 2,600 police officers from across China were involved in breaking up the rings. Media reports say some of the children were snatched from Vietnam and offered to families in southern China. Rescued babies are aged from 10 days to 7 months old. Officials will do an autopsy on a street vendor believed to have been beaten to death by city officers in Anshun City. The official Chinese news agency says 30 demonstrators were injured during a protest against the killing in the southwestern China city. They accused city management staff of beating the disabled vendor to death over a dispute.
The Olympic Games will get underway a year from today. Organisers say they're ahead of schedule and will finish under budget. The ambitious projects completely transformed the previously neglected area of London, as Lee Wellings reports.
Coming together with precision. After years of planning and construction, the London Olympic organisers are ready to show off the progress they've made. And the latest venue, to be completed with exactly a year to go, is the Aquatic Centre.
Mind-blowing. No, I feel numb.
A project enthusiastically endorsed by Mayor Boris Johnson and still driven relentlessly forward by Chairman Sebastian Coe has impressed Olympic President Jack Rogg. But with the threat of terrorism and the recent resignations of London's two most senior police officers, Rogg knows security is the most important issue.
Security does not depend on one man or on two men. It's a team and a strategy. And the team is in place and the strategy is in place.
The reason the IOC wanted the Olympics here is legacy, the regeneration of East London. This area was wasteland, much of the soil toxic, a forgotten area next to some of the poorest communities, not just in East London, but in the whole of England. World champion triple jumper Philip Zadowu grew up near the Olympic Park.
being a local borough, I've seen the developments going on in all of the Olympic boroughs in East London, so it's great to see, because Hackney, 10 years ago, it just wasn't a place to be, wasn't safe, and there wasn't really much happening. So with this now, it's just completely revitalised the whole area.
The organisers are proud of their work on this Olympic stadium with its 80,000 capacity, the centrepiece of the Olympic Park, finished ahead of schedule and under budget. But millions of people have been left unhappy about failing to get tickets. Others are sceptical of the cost and the fact that local people won't necessarily benefit. The minister who drove through the Games insists the public are behind it.
Not everybody is going to get the Olympic bug, but all I can tell you is that in this country, an overwhelming majority of people support the Olympics, are excited by the Olympics, and as you rightly say, the fact that there were 22.5 million applications for tickets speaks for itself.
The Aquatic Centre will still be here, albeit with adjustments, when the Games are over. The Olympic effect will have changed East London for good. Lee Wellings, Al Jazeera, at the Olympic Park.
Thanks for listening to Al Jazeera English on the Radio, broadcast exclusively by the Pacifica Radio Network, free speech radio.
Okay, here are the details for dinner with Delphine. That's me, Delphine Blue. I host Shocking Blue here on WBAI 99.5 FM, Thursday and Friday mornings at 10. All right, so have you ever had a question you were burning to ask me about or a story you wanted to tell me? This is your opportunity over dinner with five other WBAI listeners. You could ask me about dogs. You could ask me about music. You could ask me whatever you want. I'm not promising I will answer your question, however, but if you want a bid on a seat for dinner with Delphine, that's me, you go to WBAIauction.org. That's WBAIauction.org. And I know it's summertime and it's no time for deadlines, but there is a deadline, so do this by the 31st of July. Got it? Bon appetit.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time is 7:02. Time for an extended edition of Off the Hook.
Hence on gay marriage.
No, that's not our intro. Where's our intro? No, it's not over there either. They moved it. No, it's not there. Okay, hang on. We're going to figure this out. Oh, I see. Somebody pressed that button. Okay. Let's start that again. We'll erase that. It's 2 minutes after 7 o'clock. You're listening to WBAI New York. It's time once again for an extended edition of Off the Hook.
Understood, but did it go?
And good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Manuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening for an extended two-hour program, special fundraising edition, joined tonight by Mike.
Hello.
Dotret.
Hello.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Voltaire. Hey. Down in Philadelphia, Bernie S.
Greetings.
And we're going to have Kevin Mitnick joining us. In fact, we're going to try to Skype again. We're going to see if this works. If it doesn't work, we're going to go by telephonic communications. Well, I understand we're having some trouble with that as well. Kevin's in Spain. I don't know what he's doing in Spain, but he's in Spain right now, and that's why we have to track him down.
Apparently he's talking on the phone in Spain is what he's doing.
Well, he's talking on the phone. Oh, because he's on
not,
the phone right now.
Not to us.
Oh, so he was giving an interview. Kevin's in demand, and Kevin's going to be even more demand next month when this new book comes out. He has it's incredible. I have a preview copy of it, a galley copy. It's called Ghost in the Wires, and it's simply an incredible story. It's the story that the feds did not want him to tell. Is that a proper phrasing, Bernie?
Well, I don't know if those are the phrases they use, but they prohibited him from profiting from any telling of his story for, I think, a whole decade or then some. And he's not under that restriction anymore. So this was an effort, I think, to prevent this book from being written.
Right. Well, it's written now, and it's about to come out. And I've been reading. I've gotten about halfway through it, and I only did that in a few days. It's really riveting, and I think there's a movie in here, and I think there's all kinds of incredible stories. A lot of things you might have heard in the past through different eyes. For instance, the quote unquote movie Takedown, which I don't have enough to say about that that garbage that came out.
And John Markoff.
Yeah, well, there are all kinds of people who took advantage of Kevin's story, but never Kevin. And now Kevin can finally speak his mind and say what happened, how it happened. And it's really an interesting accounting, because it's not there really is not as much bitterness as you might think because of all the things that happened, all the bad things that happened to him. Takes responsibility for a lot of his own actions, but kind of paints a picture, and you see how the world, it might be very familiar to a lot of our listeners, you see a very unfair way that hackers are characterized and how certain assumptions are made. So, okay, are we going to try this? We're going to try Skype's all set up?
Allegedly, he's connected right now.
Really? Okay, so all I have to do is bring this up and, wait, which one? It's the one over here. All right, so is Kevin on the line?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Oh, my God. Wow. Okay. And more importantly, you can hear us.
Yeah, and I hear myself.
Okay. Well, that's not so bad. We might go to the phone if this proves to be annoying, but for the moment, I think it's okay. Well, welcome to Off the Hook, Kevin.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here. I'm in Barcelona, Spain right now, so it's a little bit late, but I keep hackers hours, so I'm wide awake, and I look forward to being on your show.
Okay. Well, is your phone ringing? Because I don't think that's our phone.
That's definitely not my phone.
Wait, whose phone is that?
I think that's your phone.
We don't have... is it coming up in the same pot, the phones in the tally room and the Skype connection? Or is that a call coming into us? Is that how they're set up? Okay, we're still learning. We're learning how this whole process works. I don't know where that phone call came from. All right.
You can call me on the backup phone number that you guys have.
Well, we've been trying to call you on that, but the hotel receptionist says that there is no phone line available from the lobby to your room. I don't know what that means. It sounds like they're messing with you again.
That sounds really weird. I'll call the reception and go, like, what the hell's going on? Because I don't know why they're not placing... I mean... Let me pick up the phone.
Well, I mean, you sound good now.
I mean, if this sounds good, this works.
Let's try this until, well, there's five of us in the room now. When three of us vote to change to a phone, we will change to a phone. Right now, how do we feel? We feel this is a good connection? Yeah. I say it is a good connection.
Well,
Mike?
I'm the one who dialed the phone before, and that was a total failure, so this is much better.
Well, it's easier for you. I know that. But
no, forget about easier. All I could talk to was the receptionist.
Okay. Well, for now, you think this connection is good?
Better than the receptionist.
Okay, Dotret, what do you think?
I vote for Skype.
Okay, good. Well, it doesn't matter what the rest of you think because we have a majority now, three people. So, all right, we'll keep checking in every few minutes and we'll see if we have to change that. Okay, so Kevin, tell us how this book came about. How long have you been planning on writing this?
I mean, it's been coming about for like it feels like a lifetime. As you probably already know, when I settled my case with the government back in 1999, I had to agree that I wouldn't profit from telling my story for 7 years. And that was part of the deal with the federal government. And initially, what the federal government wanted is for me never to be able to tell my story and try to impose a lifetime ban like they did on Kevin Polson. I believe Kevin Polson cannot write a story. So they wanted me to accept these same terms and conditions, and I flatly refused and said, you know, we're going to take the case to trial and then I'll have no conditions. And we've settled on the 7 years. So that 7 years actually was from 7 years from when I was released from custody on January of 2000, which you were there, if you remember.
I do.
And so that brought us up to 2007. And what had happened is, you know, I think there was like a year wait after 2007. And then finally, my agent, David Fugate at Launchbooks, decided he was going to try to shop around the story to see if he can get interest. And surprisingly enough, it was really hard to sell the book because they said, well, we already know the story. You know, there's already been, you know, a few books written about you. So what else is there to tell?
Yeah, that's interesting, Kevin, because I know John Markoff and Sutomo Shimomura had no trouble at all selling the story a mere months after you were captured and making, $1 million from it?
I think it was nearly $1 million, you know, and that's what I heard. I don't know for absolutely certain. But don't forget, John Markoff was able to, you know, pen articles on the front, you know, which ended up on the front page of the New York Times. So that was like a huge a huge selling point, is be able to, you know, if I could pen my own article and it's going to be on the front page of the New York Times, I'm sure I could sell my book too.
Well, all you have to do is hack the New York Times website and then you can put your stories in the front page.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a brilliant idea.
All right.
Maybe I got to just stay here in Spain and hope they won't extradite me then.
Well, there's enough stories like that in the book, but continue telling us how the book actually came to be.
So anyway, finally, Little Brown, a publisher in New York, was interested in the project. And after a lot of negotiation back and forth, they finally commissioned the book. And I decided to work with Bill Simon, who worked with me on the last two books, The Art of Deception and Art of Intrusion. And so we worked on this project together for 2 years. And now, mind you, Bill is a lot older than me. He's like, he's from a different generation. And so he has much different working habits than I. You know, he's the type of guy that's up at 6 a.m., you know, eats breakfast at 7, starts to work in front of his computer at 8, and 8 o'clock is when I'm going to sleep. So it was a real interesting process of how we were able to work together on this project, because we just had different working hours. Like, I was on European time zone, and, you know, he was on California time zone. And finally, after 2 years, we finished the project. And again, it was difficult because I was working with Bill, who wasn't really knowledgeable in, you know, computer hacking vernacular and some of the stuff I wanted to put in there of, you know, of a technical nature. So it required a lot of going back and forth over the manuscript for, you know, multiple times until we were able to get it, you know, just right. And I was of the mind, unless it was, you know, pretty much spot on, I didn't want it to be published. So we were actually late with the manuscript, but the publisher liked it so much that they forgave us and continued on with the project. So I'm really excited that on August 15th is the first publication date, and the book will be pre-released at, I believe it will be at the DEF CON bookstore, and I have a book signing on my birthday, August 6th. So that'll be really exciting. On my birthday, the book is coming out. So that's an awesome birthday present.
It really is. And it's great that I'm actually going to see you there. I might as well tell people this now. For the first time in 11 years, I'm going to be going to DEF CON in Las Vegas, which takes place the first weekend of August. And for those of you, all the people that have been emailing us and wanting to know how they can get the hacker calendar, which we were offering last week. Well, guess what? We're not going to be offering it this week because we said we weren't going to. We said we were only offering it for 1 week at a time. But that will be available at the DEF CON conference. It'll be debut there, in fact. You can see it for yourself. And you can see Kevin as well. Kevin will be there. And it's going to be a whole lot of fun. But if you're not going down there, or if you are going down there and you want to get a special edition of the book, a special autographed copy, and support the radio station at the same time, then we suggest you give a call now to 212-209-2950. Let me tell you what you will get for your phone call. For a pledge of $75, you'll get an autographed copy of Ghost in the Wires, by Kevin Mitnick. You will also get a copy of the movie Freedom Downtime, which is something that we at 2600 put together that documents the story of Kevin Mitnick while he was still in prison. And what's interesting about that is conflicts with a lot of the news accounts of the time, but it runs in very nice parallel to the story as it's told in this book. And you'll see how certain things were mentioned there that weren't mentioned anywhere else that turned out to be the truth. And it was it's an incredible way to see how history is made. So for a pledge of $75, you get those two things. And you also get, and this is really a cool thing, a free Kevin bumper sticker. We found a stash of these things that we never put on vehicles or police cars. And we didn't do that. Other people did, though. And you'll get one of those for a pledge of $75, 212-209-2950. Now, if you want a little bit more, for a pledge of $125, you get all of that. You get the book, you get the movie, you get the bumper sticker. But in addition, you get about a dozen DVDs from the Hope conferences over the years that somehow involved Kevin Mitnick, whether it be in the year 1997. Now, Kevin, you were in prison in 1997, but we still had a Kevin Mitnick panel. Your lawyer was on the telephone. And we talked to him and grilled him, asked him all kinds of questions. And it was really the first opportunity to actually dispel a lot of the myths. So that was a very significant thing back then. Of course, you gave the keynote address at the Fifth Hope in 2004. And you were there at the Last Hope. You were at the Next Hope on the Informants panel. We have all of that and more for a pledge of $125. So it's a great Mitnick package, two Mitnick packages that we have tonight. And tonight is Kevin Mitnick night as far as WBAI is concerned. 212-209-2950. Let's see those phones light up with all kinds of people in the hacker world that are interested in the story. I'd like to read, if I may, the first paragraph of the book. Do I have permission to do that, Kevin?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, good. I don't want to violate any copyright laws. Okay, this is from Chapter 1, Rough Start. My mother never drove around with one of those bumper stickers that said my son was Student of the Month. There were other bumper stickers that would appear about me later on, but even when I was a boy, my talents were never the kind that would have won the heart of a school teacher. And that's certainly true, of course, making reference to the free Kevin stickers that came later on. And it's the start of an amazing story.
And you get one of those stickers when you pledge?
You get one of those stickers. If you pledge $125, you get two of those stickers.
Ooh.
Yeah. So,
and there's probably no other way to get one unless you peel one off a car or something.
You know, there are cars that still have the stickers. In fact, there are signs. I'm not going to say where, but there are signs all around the area that have free Kevin stickers still on them. And we went to a really good place. They last forever. And you have to literally chisel them off, the signs, to get them. People to this day ask, who's Kevin and why isn't he free? Well, Kevin is free now. In fact, some people slice their stickers in half and reverse the words to say Kevin Free after he was released back in 2000.
So if you get two stickers, you can do that with one of them and keep the other pristine.
That's right. That's right. But I have seen stickers that have been up since 1998 and are still up and still look pretty good. So these are quality stickers. And if your name is Kevin, then it's even better. I've had policemen stop me to ask who Kevin is because their name was Kevin and they wanted a sticker for themselves just as kind of a goof for their co-employees. And yeah, it's incredible how that movement sort of took off and really became a part of the American culture. People seem to recognize the phrase "Free Kevin." When's the first time you actually? I think you were in the Metropolitan Detention Center in Los Angeles, Kevin, when you heard about the Free Kevin stickers, right?
Oh yeah, and in fact, you know, you and several people from I believe 2600 showed up on my 35th birthday. And that was when I was able, you know, when I had a Free Kevin bumper sticker that somebody mailed me in the post that the prison authorities, I think, missed. And I was able to go down to the law library on the third floor of the detention center and press the sticker to the window when somebody was across the street photographing me. And I think that ended up on your on your cover for the DVD set.
Yeah, and it's also it's in Freedom Downtime as well, and you can see us. Basically, we were waving across the street at this monolithic building, horrible architecture with just little slots for windows, and that was your eye into the world. And we couldn't find you. We couldn't figure out where you were. We had arranged to be across the street at the mobile station at a particular time. And we couldn't, we were looking at every single one of those little slots, seeing if we could see a face, and we heard this tapping noise. And we knew that was you. We just were trying to figure out where the tapping noise was coming from. And eventually we found the window, we saw your face, and we were able to wave, and everybody was really happy. But then I understand what happened afterwards in the actual prison. There was all kinds of mayhem as a result of this.
Yeah, what they did is they locked down the prison. What I did was I went into another inmate's room with their permission, and was able to use a can of snuff. And with the snuff, I was able to tap Morse code on the window. And that's what you guys heard, across the street at the mobile station. And it took a while. And then eventually I only wanted to do that for a short period of time because I knew that the prison staff would call up to that floor. I believe I was on the sixth floor. And they would have, asked where I was to see if I was instigating this protest and then try to find a reason to put me in the hole. But I was pretty quick on doing it, and they got out of there and was cut pretty much in plain sight. So when they got the call, I looked at the guard, and the guard looked directly at me, and I could see his lips move, saying, "No, he's right in front of me. He's not doing anything." So otherwise, I would probably be put into solitary confinement again. With the Free Kevin bumper stickers, I actually was doing a speech out here in Valencia, Spain, and I've actually found 10 or 15 of those stickers at home, and I brought them and I signed them and I gave them away. Uh-huh. But I ran out, so if you have any extras, I could take some and
give them out as well. If you pledge, Kevin, $75 or $125, you can get one or two of those stickers.
I'd have to make a lot of pledges to get more stickers.
Well, we'll see what we can work out for you. By the way, I need to apologize to listeners. For some reason, every time somebody calls in, some bozo hooked it up so that the Skype and the phone are on the same channel. We're trying to figure out how to separate them. Every time somebody calls in, we get a loud ring over that channel. So we're trying to figure that out. We've got our best people on it right now. Again, the phone number to call, which it's good that people are calling. I'm not berating people for calling. Please continue to call. 212-209-2950. This is a one-time offer. You're not going to see this anyplace else. It's an incredible book. For a pledge of $75, you get the autographed copy of Kevin Mitnick's new book, Ghost in the Wires. And you also get a copy of Freedom Downtime, the documentary, the independent documentary that we put out to counter all the nonsense that was being spread around back then in the late 90s about the Kevin Mitnick story and how he was capable of starting World War III from a touch-tone phone just by whistling into it. All kinds of amazing stories that were just completely made up and believed by everybody from the mass media to federal judges. So you'll get that, and you'll get a free Kevin bumper sticker, all for a pledge of $75. For $125, you'll get all that, plus about a dozen DVDs from various Hope conferences over the years. I'd like to play an excerpt from one of those right now. This is from 1997. The Beyond Hope conference. We're going to listen to a little bit of Kevin Mitnick's lawyer, Donald Randolph, as he was talking to the Hope conference back in 1997 about Kevin's case, which back then very few people knew the facts about. The film had not yet even been started, and Kevin was basically languishing in prison without much of a chance of getting out. 1997, Beyond Hope. Please give us a call, 212-209-2950.
We had some information before, which has since changed. Kevin has been in communication with us, and we were going to have him speak, just say hello. He really can't say anything. He anything he says will be used against him in one way or another. But after talking with his lawyer and after talking with him, we all kind of reached the conclusion that it wouldn't be in his best interest to actually talk directly to the conference. He did, however, convey that he wants to say he's sorry that he can't say something directly. He has received all of your mail. He would like to be able to reply. However, everything he says is subject to be read and to be misinterpreted in all kinds of manners by the authorities. So we do have his lawyer with us. on the line. Actually, let's make sure we have him on the line with us. Don Randolph, are you there?
Well, I'm here, but I can't hear you very well.
Okay. Well, actually, that doesn't really matter because I'm going to read this press release, and then we'll give you a chance to make a statement, and we'll relay some questions from the and whatever press people are still awake that may want to get the other side of the story for a change, because I don't think we've ever actually heard anything other than what people like John Markoff have to say about Kevin Mitnick. Before I begin, I will be playing this for Kevin over the phone sometime this week, and the first thing I would like for him to hear would be a good round of applause from everybody. This is one of the most incredible cases I think we've ever seen, and a real indication of the sickness of some of the people in charge of prosecutions. I'd like to read this press release, then turn it over to Don Randolph to give us a statement and take some questions.
Yes, we're not going to have the part where I read the press release. We're going to go straight to Donna Randolph.
To tell us, obviously, but any questions concerning what has already happened, I'm sure would be welcome. First question, go ahead.
What specifically are the alleged events that led to Kevin's arrest?
Well, there have been a number of books written upon the subject, and Kevin has advised me that the facts in those books, there's a lot of poetic license that's been taken in order to, when he was finally arrested in North Carolina. All I can tell you is that it occurred in February of 1995, and Jonathan Lippman book was probably the closest to the mark in terms of the events which occurred. So, rather than make a long story short, I think that book is probably the one that if anything that's out in the media now, that's the one that probably explains the details most succinctly.
Well, I'd like to ask what Kevin's mood has been from the beginning of this. Has he experienced, I guess, a lot of depression from being in prison for 2.5 years and... what kinds of things make him feel better? What can we do?
Well, I know one thing that would make him feel better is if we are able to be successful in the bail motion that we're putting together right now. There is nothing glamorous about being an inmate in custody, and I think it doesn't make any difference whether it's federal or state custody. It is for 100 different reasons. Obviously, the intellectually, those we can appreciate, but personally, until one has experienced it, I think that it's impossible to understand what the deprivation of rights is, and being thrust into a community where you're completely at the behest of prison guards, people who are bureaucrats in the system, to whom you are a number. So, having said that, let me talk to you in a couple of ways. First, his mood. I've been representing Kevin since last October, and he was in difficult straits when I started to represent him because he felt as if the negotiations had bogged down there at that point in time in terms of trying to allow him to resolve his difficulties with the government in a reasonable fashion. And what Kevin at that time considered, and what I also consider is unreasonable, is a sentence in the 10-year plus range for what he has allegedly done. We both consider that to be unreasonable, and so he was obviously depressed by that prospect and by the fact that that's what the government, that seemed to be their position at the time. Since then, the Kevin that I've gotten to know is a young man who's intellectually active, but has a good sense of humor. And if there's one thing that has saved him, I think allowed him to keep his marbles throughout this process, is that he has a good sense of humor. And so we try to find those instances, regardless of the fact that he's in custody, we try to never lose that.
Three questions, maybe. The third maybe doesn't really need an answer, but let's have some fun with some of this. The first thing that struck me as they talked about taking away Kevin Mitnick's right to a computer is that he is, among other things, a writer for a computer magazine beloved by almost everyone in this hall. And so I'm wondering, what are the First Amendment consequences of talking about a magazine writer saying that he can't access what is now an absolute basic tool of his trade, a computer? And that seems profound.
Well, first the answer is, if you ask me, the answer is yes. But I'm not the one to make the rules. Let me give you, just take a second and tell you, because this is also another aspect of this case, which may spawn some circuit court opinions. When it came down, we had sentencing a couple weeks ago in the two smaller cases, as I mentioned. And if and when we get him, not if, when we get Kevin out of custody in this case, then he will have to be on supervised release from that case at a minimum for a period of 3 years. So the judge had to address the issue of what conditions she was going to place on it. These are supervised release is the federal court's fancy word for conditions of probation. The court first came forth with her proposed conditions of probation. And let me just read, happen to have them handy here. So I'll just pick out a couple. The defendant shall not possess or use for any purpose portable laptop computers and derivatives, any other electronic equipment presently available or new technology that becomes available that can be converted to or has as its function a computer-related capability. It seems to me that pretty much covers everything that we have now and everything that we'll be using in our daily lives in the next 10 years. Let's see here. The defendant shall not access computers or other forms of wireless communications via third parties and shall not act as a consultant to individuals or groups engaged in any computer-related activity. The government came forward with their own series of proposed conditions of special release, and they included the following. Defendant shall not participate in any conference, meeting, seminar, class, or discussion relating to computer hacking, the unauthorized access of telecommunication systems or computer networks, or security issues with respect to such systems. He shall not communicate to or receive from any person or person any instructions or information relating to the access, programming, or use of computer systems, computer networks, or telecommunication systems or devices. When we got these proposed conditions from the court, we argued that we thought they were a tad over-restrictive. And in order to comply with them, really the only safe place for my client would be in a cabin deep in the woods without electricity or running water, writing his memoirs by candlelight. And we hesitated to point out to the court, look what happened to Ted Kaczynski under those circumstances.
Yes, okay. Oh, Don Randolph had a real way with words. That's Kevin Mitnick's lawyer back in 1997 talking on the phone with the Beyond Hope Conference. This has never before been made available, and it's part of the $125 package with all things Mitnick, where you'll get every single talk that Kevin has given, as well as talks about Kevin that have happened at the various Hope conferences, those are Hackers on Planet Earth conferences that have taken place here in New York. In addition, you get the brand new Kevin Mitnick book, Ghost in the Wires, autographed, which is coming out next month. You'll get the 2-hour movie plus at least as much in extra features DVD that we put out back in 2001 called Freedom Downtime. You'll get a couple of Kevin Mitnick Free Kevin bumper stickers. That's for a pledge of $125, 212-209-2950. If you just want the book and the movie, a pledge of $75 will get you that. And you'll get one bumper sticker, too, free Kevin bumper sticker. You can put anywhere you want. 212-209-2950. We've had a bunch of calls so far. We want to get some more people calling in to take advantage of this this one-time offer that we're offering tonight. We're on for 2 hours tonight because Kevin is our very special guest talking to us all the way from Spain on a Skype connection. Kevin, are you still there? Oh, dear.
I could hear you loud and clear.
Oh, okay. I had the wrong thing up. Okay. I'm sorry. It was my fault. I don't know. Were you able to hear Donald Randolph?
Oh, yeah. It reminds me of the old days.
Yeah. You know, there was a rumor, and maybe you can clarify this rumor now, back in 1997, the Beyond Hope conference, there was a rumor that you were listening in on the phone throughout the whole thing. Is that true?
No, that's not true at all.
Okay. That rumor has now been dispelled. So, okay.
No, I mean, I had a lot of restricted access to the telephone when I was in custody. I mean, they were pretty afraid of me. So we didn't get to use the phone all that much.
Well, I'd like to talk about that, actually, because first of all, for those of you who don't know, and I've been told there are people who don't know who Kevin Mitnick is. Kevin Mitnick, in the 1990s and beyond, was labeled by the mass media in this country as the most dangerous hacker in the world. Was that the moniker you had to wear?
I remember a quote from Time magazine. It said something like, you know, handing a telephone to Mitnick was like handing a machine gun to a hitman. And that was pretty scary because,
wow.
You know, the guards in the detention center in Los Angeles kept passing that all around, you know, and then it made them even more concerned about what I can do with a telephone. They were like scared. It was like a mysterious, magical thing that they had no idea how I could manipulate.
Well, that's amazing because speaking of what you can do with a telephone, the story of what Judge Feltzer?
Feltzer. Feltzer. Mariana Feltzer.
Yeah, she had some notion as to what you could do with a phone, and I believe she imposed some rather severe restrictions on you at some point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at one point, a prosecutor had stood up in federal court and it claimed that I could whistle. I could first dial NORAD and somehow communicate with a modem and whistle into the modem and cause a nuclear strike. And of course, when he said this in court, I kind of laughed, figuring that the judge, he would lose all credibility with the judge because only a moron would believe anything like that. And of course, the judge appeared to believe it and then made a special order that I wasn't to be anywhere near a telephone. And they set up this high security method of allowing me to make phone calls, which, by the way, I defeated. That's in the book. And, you know, because I was at the bottom of the bucket, I had nothing to lose. And because of that, I was held in the hole, which was a solitary confinement for nearly a year, you know, based on this myth that I could, you know, whistle the codes. Now, I've been practicing, Eric, over time, and I think I got the whistle down where I could actually do it.
Okay, hold on a second. Wait, Tony, is this okay? We gotta check with management to see if we can whistle those. This is to start a nuclear war or to continue
one?
I don't
know if you can hear it, but let me try.
I gotta make sure we can do this. Mike, are we all right? Do we do nuclear whistles over the air? What if NORAD is listening?
We just have to make sure our listeners do not put their telephone near radio, which should be okay.
If you're listening to this, do not put your phone anywhere near the radio speaker because what could happen, we're using Skype, so it's not using the phone lines, but if you were to get a phone line involved in this, then it could open up those like doors somewhere in Idaho and nuclear missiles could start being launched. Is that my understanding?
Bernie S. is on the phone.
Bernie, do you know anything about this?
I'm afraid that could be true if you believe what the government was saying.
Why would you believe what the government says?
He's on the phone right now. This entire conversation is going over a phone line.
Bernie, hit the mute button. For God's sake, hit the mute button. All right, Kevin, whistle the things. I assume our listeners are not holding the phone up to the speaker now. Okay. You risk the nation being destroyed.
So I get it right, but here it goes.
All right, here we go.
Hopefully it will work.
All right. No, hopefully it won't work.
Thank you.
That's here. That's happening right here. Oh, dear. All right. We're sorry. We didn't mean to end civilization, but...
Well, yeah, that clearly, but I think something just blew up.
Yeah. Well, things have to blow up, don't they? Kevin, you know, I didn't realize how dangerous you were until today, and I see what the government had in mind. But you mentioned something. You said this is in the book, and okay, I guess we won't reveal the secret tonight, but let's just say that you were in the situation where you were being watched by a guard. You could only dial a couple of numbers. You were not allowed to touch the phone physically, yet somehow you were able to evade security and bypass it. Is that correct?
Well, I can tell the story. I mean, it's only one story in the book, and there's so many stories that telling one story out of... I mean, do we have time?
Of course,
Do I have about 3 minutes?
Go nuts.
Okay, awesome. So I was in solitary confinement, so imagine when I had to make a phone call, they had a special log, and the officer took me out of my cell and handcuffed me and actually shackled my legs, because you're in the hole, so you're in the highest security possible. You know, it's the same security as if I killed a prison guard. So then they would escort me to this room that had like 3 payphones on the wall, you know, 3 typical looking payphones from Pacific Bell. Then they take the shackles off, the handcuffs off. And then the guard had a logbook. And I think there was 5 authorized numbers I was allowed to call. It was my mom, my dad, my aunt, my lawyer, and my wife at the time. And My wife at the time worked for General Telephone, and during the day she was at work, she wasn't at home, and the only number on the list was the home number. So, after, you know, and this happened, you know, a little bit after I was in the hole for a while. It wasn't like instantaneously I decided to do this, but I figured I'm already at the bottom of the bucket, so what did I have to lose? I'm in solitary confinement in a federal prison, you know, where the government says I could launch nuclear weapons by whistling into a telephone. I had nothing to lose. So what I started doing is pacing back and forth, because the cord of the handset was, you know, longer than typical. And I would be scratching my back, you know, with the other hand. I'd be constantly like, you know, like I had a rash or something, which I didn't have, but I'd pretend. And then I would actually rub my back against the payphone. So during a phone call, like, for example, to my father, I'd you know, have a conversation. And after the conversation ended, I'd continue as if I was talking to him, and then I would like rub my back against the payphone. Then I'd put my hand behind my back as I'm leaning against the payphone and hold down the switch hook for a second. And then immediately I'd put my hand in front of me, because as you know, once you hit the switch hook, you have about 18 seconds before the phone's gonna go into reorder. And during this whole time, the guard is sitting in a chair 4 to 5 feet in front of me, watching my every move. So then I would pace like one more time, and then I'd lean against the phone again. And then I was pretty adept at using a touchscreen pad after having, you know, a decade of phone freaking, you know, under me. So I simply just dialed 0 plus the number behind the back, which it was easy to do because the number at General Telephone at the time was 805-371-6000. So it's not a difficult number to dial. And so I would still be in mid-conversation, pretending to have a conversation. And the next thing that was going to happen was the operator was going to come up on the line and ask, you know, who the collect calls from. So what I had to do is, oh, yeah, well, you know, tell Uncle Jerry that Kevin says hello. And at the point I said Kevin is when the operator goes, well, who's the collect call from? So I'd continue in conversation, and eventually the call, you know, would be saved, and the person would accept the call, and then they'd be talking to the new person. And I started doing this constantly right under their eye. I mean, they're sitting there watching me. So after about 3.5 weeks, around 6 a.m. one morning, my cell door opens, and it's the executives of the prison. And they shackle me, you know, again, handcuffs, leg irons. They move me to the attorney conference room on the 8th floor of the Metropolitan Detention Center, and they take off the handcuffs, and they say, Mitnick, yeah, how are you doing it? And I go, how am I doing what? They go, you're redialing the number. You're somehow redialing the phone. And I kind of had like a look on my face like, what? I said, how can I be redialing the phone? Well, Mr. Mitnick, you know, we monitor all prison, you know, all inmate phone calls, you know, down in our room. And we know you're redialing the phone, even when our officer is not taking his eyes off you. How are you doing it? And then I simply smiled and, you know, I sat back and smiled and said, hey, I'm not David Copperfield. I don't know what you're talking about. Well, they got kind of pissed off. They shackled me back up, threw me back in my cell. And then 2 days later, I hear like some drilling outside the cell. And it's actually Pacific Bell technicians installing a phone jack. And I'm thinking to myself, are these idiots actually going to install a phone in my cell and try to restrict the numbers that I can call? Or, you know, because a lot was passing through my mind, like what could they be doing? Well, the very next time I had to make a phone call, I figured it out. Is the officer brings a phone, a regular like home phone, plugs it into the jack, and he dials the number I want to call, and then he puts the handset on a long 25-foot cord through the trap door and the cell door, where they give you food and stuff, and that way I couldn't reach the touch tone pad. So I kind of thought, wow, this is like Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. So that's how I was able to pretty much call anybody I wanted, even though I was in solitary confinement and under a court-ordered phone restriction.
Wow. That is unreal. And just the fact that you had that sense of rebellion in you, that even under these horrendous conditions, and by horrendous conditions, you were in solitary confinement. Your cell was, what, 8x10?
That or smaller. I mean, I don't recall the actual measurements, but yeah, something like 8x10. It had a bunk, it had a toilet. I mean, it was very restrictive because you're in a high security unit. You know, like my neighbors were guys from the Mexican mafia.
Well,
I think there was a guy that was a DEA agent that became became a criminal. And so these guys were like in, you know, high security. So it definitely wasn't the highlight of my life. It really sucked. And
well, yeah,
I can't imagine the people that are in Supermax in Colorado, like Theodore Kaczynski, that my attorney brought up as the Unabomber.
Right.
Because these guys experienced that forever. You know, and I was going bonkers like after a week. You know, I'm probably a little bit crazy today from it.
Well, the thing is, and what you bring up in the book, imagine, you say this to the readers, imagine just living inside a closet for months at a time. You get out 1 hour a day to walk around in a slightly bigger space and breathe actual air. But imagine just having that as your room, where you're fed through that little slot in the door, and your contact with the outside world is extremely limiting, and just how insane that will drive you. And it's hard for any of us, I think, to imagine what it is that motivated you to keep trying to beat the system and succeeding in beating the system so many times, and just to keep that spirit. It's an incredible thing, regardless of your background, just to have that spirit.
Yeah, I mean, even when I was a fugitive, I remember, you know, I needed a new identity. And at the time, I didn't want to, at first I used an identity of somebody else, but that wasn't going to be permanent because, you know, that's how you get caught. So back in those days when I was like 11, 12 years old, I used to frequent this bookstore in North Hollywood, California called the Survival Bookstore. And they had all the books on subjects you weren't supposed to know about. And my favorite book was called The Paper Trip by a guy named Barry Reed. And it described how to, you know, create yourself a new identity and disappear forever. And what it described is basically, you know, hijacking the birth, you know, basically when an infant passed away at a very young age and had no other records in the infant's name, how you could basically take over that, you know, deceased person's identity and become them. So I did some research and found out that there was about 14 states that had open birth and death records. And one of them was, and I wanted to find a state that was kind of a place where people wouldn't think I'd ever go. And what I did is I picked South Dakota. And so I remember before I went to South Dakota, I did a little bit of prep work. I went to a supermarket and they had a business card printing machine. So you put in $5 and you press in your name and your address and who you want to be. And, you know, within 3 minutes out pops the business cards. So I had a flashback of the old TV series, The Rockford Files, you know, where James Rockford, you know, had the business card printer in his car.
Yes.
And what I did is I created a business card that said the name I was using at the time, which was Eric Weiss, you know, paying tribute to, you know, Harry Houdini, because that was his real name, is I had these cards printed up that said Eric Weiss, private investigator, an address in Las Vegas, and a PI number. And that, and armed with those business cards in a nice suit, I went to the Bureau of Vital Statistics in South Dakota, went in the front door. I told them that I was a private investigator doing an ongoing investigation, and I needed access to the death records. And then I was introduced to the actual person that was the head of the Bureau of Vital Statistics for all of South Dakota. And I told her the same story. And she goes, "No problem, Mr. Weiss. What we'll do is just tell us the names of the people you want, and we'll just print out the death certificates for you, and we'll be happy to do it. And, you know, this is what it will cost." I said, no, you don't understand. As I'm doing a research project or an investigation on the causes of death in certain years, about 20 to 30 years ago, so I need to go ahead and I need to be able to browse the death certificates.
Oh, boy.
So what they did is the head lady told one of her employees to go ahead and train me on the microfiche. So they trained me on the fiche. They showed me to access all the films for the year. And they put me in this back room. And basically, for a whole week, I was in the back room researching people that died around 1 or 2 years of age, and they were where they were born in a different state, and a year that I could, you know, pass for, and obviously a Caucasian, you know, with the color of the eyes, you know, and all that sort of thing. So everything matched up. And the very next day, one of the staff in the Bureau of Vital Statistics says, "Hey, I heard you're a private investigator." I go, "Yeah." She goes, "I have an uncle. I think he's in Las Vegas, and I haven't spoken to him in years. Do you think you can help me find him?" I go, "I'll give it a shot." So I went back to my hotel that evening, and, you know, of course, you know, with LexisNexis and Westlaw, I was able to find the uncle in about 2 minutes. Got it, you know, I was able to use social engineering skills to get the phone number because it was a non-published number. I go back to the, you know, the Bureau of Vital Statistics the next day. I give this lady the information, and literally she's hugging me and can't believe that, you know, now she can call this her uncle. And I mean, and for the next week I'm in there, she's bringing me donuts and coffee.
Wow.
Bringing me donuts. And I'm sitting there doing all this research. And then I get annoyed. And why did I get annoyed? Is in this room, they had all these printers going. And it was annoying because, you know, I needed some peace and quiet because I'm trying to quickly go through as, you know, 10 years of death certificates in as quick time, you know, as quickly as possible. So I walk over to the printers and my jaw drops because what was in the box was blank birth certificates for the state of South Dakota.
Oh, dear.
And I go, "Oh, my God." To me, you know, being a fugitive from the FBI, that was like hitting a jackpot, right? So I look at the other boxes that weren't, you know, obviously fed into the printer, and they were just blank birth certificate stock. So, of course, I ripped myself, you know, I took about 50 certificates. And then the problem was is those certificates aren't worth the paper they're printed on unless they're embossed with the state seal.
Right.
So outside this room of where I was, they basically have the embosser. And any time an employee would have to emboss a death certificate, a marriage certificate, or birth certificate, they'd walk over to this table and emboss it, then walk back to their desk. So the very next day, it was kind of like snow flurries in South Dakota. So I brought my ski jacket into the office there. And you know how government employees are when, you know, when it's lunchtime, it's lunchtime. They don't do any work. So knowing this, around 12:30 sharp, I walk to the restroom. I take my ski jacket. And on the way back, I basically take the embosser and put it under my jacket, walk into the room, which is 5 feet away. And then my heart's beating like crazy because if I get caught, you know, the jig is up, right? Not only am I going to get in trouble for, you know, embossing my own birth certificates, you know, I'm going to get in trouble for everything else. So my heart's pounding as I'm embossing 50 of these certificates. And of course, nothing ever happens. I'm able to put the embosser back where it was. And I walk out the door with 50 blank birth certificates to become 50 new people that I want to be.
Wow.
So that's kind of a crazy story because I think it takes a lot of chutzpah. Because when I look back at it today, I'm thinking, damn, I was crazy. Because, you know, yeah, I mean, I was nuts.
Yeah, well,
I would never do anything like that today. But
back then, you know, I had a lot of chutzpah.
Well, you're also being hunted and trying to live on your own and figure out ways to survive. And yeah, this is kind of what you have to do. But you sort of invented identity theft there, I think, back then. That was incredible. And you just have so many stories like this where you've ingratiated yourself with people that you think would be the last people that would take you in. For instance, if you need a password, you just pretty much waltz up to the person that has the password and ask them for it and present the scenario in such a way that they feel they have to give it to you. And it's just story after story about how you did this. It's quite inspirational, both in learning how to do this and just as an individual trying to stay free. And reading the book, you get a sense as to why you had to do that based on the background. You start off in very early in your life, in your childhood, and you see how things developed and how you basically got to where you were at that particular time in your life. I should point out that we are almost at the $1,000 mark. We need to be further than that, though. This is part of a special two-hour program that we have tonight featuring Kevin Mitnick, who we're speaking to from Spain over a Skype connection. Basically, Kevin is putting out a brand new book called Ghost in the Wires. It's coming out next month, but you can get a signed copy by pledging tonight, 212-209-2950. $75, you'll get a copy of the book. You'll get a copy of Freedom Downtime, the two-hour, two-DVD documentary filled with all kinds of extra bits in addition to the 2 hours. It tells the story about Kevin's life and his run from law enforcement. A lot of things you can learn from this whole battle as far as how someone's name can get completely tarnished with a bunch of lies, as well as how to stay one step ahead of the authorities when push comes to shove. 212-209-2950. And you also get, for a pledge of $75, a free Kevin bumper sticker. These adorned cars and stop signs and all kinds of other things in the late 1990s as the Free Kevin movement was in full swing. For a pledge of $125, you get all of that, plus an additional bumper sticker and a whole bunch of DVDs from the Hope Conferences featuring Kevin Mitnick. We're going to play an excerpt from another one of those in just a couple of moments. It's a great deal. Our pledge people at 212-209-2950 will be more than happy to explain it in further detail to you. But right now, we have to get those phones ringing. Okay, we've gone over the 1,000 mark. We have one call on the line. I'd like to see that turn into, what, six, seven? I don't think that's being too unrealistic.
I don't think so at all. And you mentioned the whole Free Kevin movement in the 90s. Mm. Some of us were there. I was there. You were there. And we were... We knew that there was a sort of sense about everything that this wasn't just another hacker that got busted. This wasn't just another case. We knew we sort of knew that however this case went was going to affect everything that happened afterward in the mm-hmm. hacker world. And even when we were around back then, there was not all that much information about what was going on behind the scenes. I mean, we had people like you, Emmanuel, who had limited contact with Kevin and were updating the rest of us. But so far as the complete story, we all had sort of these incomplete bits and pieces. And now that this book can finally come out, I think those of us who were there will learn a whole lot about what was fully going on with this whole case.
The thing is, I mean, we told the story through Freedom Downtime. We told our version of it. There was other versions that were, I think, a lot less accurate, such as what happened in the New York Times and also the movie Takedown. But now, for the first time, you get to see what Kevin has to say. You get to read all these pages filled with stories. I mean, Kevin, you can talk for hours and hours about all of these things. There are so many stories, so many things throughout the course of your life to this day that you've been involved in, things I'm learning that I didn't know about. And it's just it's fascinating. It's incredible. I've told you privately that I really think there's a movie in this book. And an interesting one, as opposed to the fictionalized one that was put out about your life. I think this is one that really will be inspirational and exciting and educational at the same time.
I just want to mention, historical interest aside, all the stuff in here is pretty darn interesting. If mm-hmm. anyone who's ever heard Kevin talking about any of his past experiences, it's riveting. The kinds of things that happened and the scenarios and how it all progresses. You very rarely come across something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, Bernie, I know you served your time in the federal pen and state pens and things like that for equally crazy reasons, and you have the same spirit of individuality and sort of rebelling against the system and outsmarting it. What do you think it is that drives people like you and Kevin?
You actually have to maintain your sanity and your mental health. You actually have to have that attitude. You have to be able to laugh at the situation as being beyond ludicrous. You have to be able to see your keepers, those who restrict your freedom, who have restricted your freedom. You have to see them for who they are, and you have to keep your chin up. Otherwise, they will get the best of you. And I commend Kevin for having done that for about 5 years. I only had to for, more or less a year and a half. But he shared something that I shared, which was the not knowing when the light would be at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
I would envy fellow prisoners who would have a release date to look forward to, as I'm sure Kevin did as well. He had no idea, as I didn't, when he's going to be getting out. And that's really tough when you're there for month after month, year after year, not knowing when this nightmare is going to be over. That's worse than serving a longer sentence and at least having a release date. So keeping your sanity, Kevin managing to keep his sanity under those conditions is pretty amazing. So I want to encourage our listeners to take that to heart and read his story. I haven't read it yet, but I've spoken with Kevin on many occasions, and I'm really impressed with how he kept his sanity during that half decade of just ridiculous, oppressive conditions. Listeners, call 212-209-2950. You're going to get from the horse's mouth, from Kevin himself, which may be one of the more objective, probably the most objective and factual revision of his story. A DVD called Freedom Downtime, which the 2600 folks, I was slightly involved with that, put this out, during when this was going on.
And you tell your story in that movie as well.
Yes, and other hackers as well. It was really an amazing time when the government didn't really know how to handle hackers. They couldn't quite wrap their mind of what we were capable of.
They still don't, though. I mean,
that's true.
Look around.
What I mean is they have a much better grasp of... They're still going to misrepresent things,
mm-hmm.
but before they were far more naive and actually believed their own BS.
Right.
Now I think they're just far more more disingenuous now, in that they know that they're just spouting nonsense and blowing smoke, whereas before they mm-hmm. really believed some of this stuff that they were saying that hackers could do, and they just didn't have the handle. They had very little technical training.
All right, we have two calls on the line. Let's make that 512-209-2950. Again, we're offering the brand new Kevin Mitnick book, Ghost in the Wires, and it's coming out next month. It tells all and then some. It's an incredible series of stories. The thing is, a lot of people, and this was true back in the 90s as well, a lot of people would come up to us and say, but he's a criminal, he deserves to be punished, and all that kind of a thing. And this is something that, if you read the book, even Kevin does not hide behind anything. He admits what it is exactly that he did. He even says that he should be punished to some degree. But the amount of punishment and the sheer irrationality of it, that is the story. That is what makes this fascinating. Just the fear that people in authority positions have of somebody who's using technology in a way that they don't understand, and the incredible restrictions and mistruths that follow somebody around for the rest of their lives. This is something, Kevin's story is something that every single one of us who is an individual can identify with to some degree. Whether or not you believe somebody is a criminal or not, if you are an individual in any way, this is something that speaks to you. 212-209-2950. Join the four calls on the line now, and get the Kevin Mitnick book, get the bumper sticker, get the movie, get the DVD series. It's just an incredible document of our time. And keep in mind, most of this, except for Kevin's release and subsequent rehabilitation into society, most of this happened before 9/11. Imagine a person like Kevin Mitnick walking around and challenging authority and outsmarting authority and technology. Imagine that happening in a post 9/11 world in America, and how he would be treated then. Kevin, do you ever think about that?
I think it's quite scary. But, it's kind of interesting because, how I got started in all of this was, primarily from phone freaking, because I was involved in the hobby of phone freaking
after a student at my high school introduced me to it, and I was just taken aback and it was just amazing to me, you know, learning about the telecommunications network. But I remember when I was in high school, I wanted to go to computer science class because another student recommended it, and I kind of poo-pooed it at first. And then when I found out the phone company was moving to electronic switching systems, I wanted to learn more about computers because I think it would, you know, give me a little bit of an edge over the phone company, or at least understanding what's going on. And I remember the teacher told me, oh, I'm sorry, Kevin, you don't have the prerequisites to get into computer class. You have to have calculus. Because back in this time, you had to be a senior with calculus to get into computer class. And I think I only had like trig or something. And I started showing the teacher, a guy named Mr. Christ, I started showing him all the tricks I could do with the telephone, you know, using loop arounds, you know, remember Roto-Rooter, you know, calling in and, mm-hmm. you know, having it play back your touch tones. And he thought it was quite interesting. He waived the prerequisites, let me into class. And then the first programming assignment in Fortran was to write a program that would find the first 100 Fibonacci numbers. And to me, that was the most boring assignment in the world. So I decided on a new assignment to write a login simulator that would simulate the login prompt to log into the school's RISTIC system, and it would steal the password and then log the person into the account. I thought that was a more interesting and practical program. So I wrote that program instead, and then I got into trouble because I ran it on all the terminals in the computer room and, you know, got everybody's password. But in any event, I told the instructor, I told Mr. Chris, I said, listen, I didn't have time to write this Fibonacci exercise, but I have my password stealer. Can you at least give me credit for that? So I got an A, right? So he said, yeah, I did a good job. You know, that was really clever. And used a little bit more ingenuity. And he gave me an A, a bunch of attaboys. So the ethics taught to me when I was in school was it was cool and fun. And you were considered a whiz kid, and it was behavior that you were awarded for. And in today's world, if I did that today and was still in high school, I'd probably be called to the principal's office and be picked up by the police.
Yeah, that's unfortunate reality. It's not like that everywhere in the world, fortunately, and maybe it can be shifted in this country as well if we simply educate people. Getting this book is maybe the first step towards educating people on that level. And I hope a lot of people call in now, 212-209-2950, pledge for the book, Kevin Mitnick, Ghost in the Wires, coming out next month, autographed copy, get the movie as well, get the DVDs, get the bumper stickers, get the whole package, learn as much as you possibly can. We're going to have more about poor Mr. Chris later on, Kevin's teacher, quite a beleaguered guy that endured a lot, and we learned a lot through him as well. We have to take a station break, though. We're on for an extra hour tonight, and Personal Computer Show will be back next week. Please give a call, 212-209-2950, and let's fill those phone lines up. Remember, we're doing this for the station, so that the station remains here and so that we have a voice to present stories like this in the future. 212-209-2950. We'll be right back. And, of course, that's the voice of